You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're back from Memorial Day break with another edition of the M Squared TechCast. Do you have a nice Monday off there, Mike?
It was great, yeah. It was nice to just do nothing.
Yeah.
With our schedules, right?
Where that is fun to do once in a while.
Chock-a-block full all the time. So, yeah, cool. And we came back to a full house as I look.
Yeah, we got a great show.
I don't normally look around the studio and see every seat filled, but we have lots of folks in here. But we're going to start off with Tim Moynihan, who's calling in from New York. He's the only one that isn't in here, I think.
We'd have to bring in another chair anyway.
Yeah, it's just as well, Tim. You know, so, but soon, as I think we've mentioned before, that we're going to what do we call it? Internet TV. Now?
Yes. Yep.
It's a good definition.
A video podcast. Whatever. Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
So we'll be able to see Tim Moynihan from New York next time he calls in July and beyond. That's when we make the transition. Scary, huh?
Yeah. Sounds like fun though.
All right. So what he's going to be talking about is Airfoil Group has come out with a new tech report, which I wrote a story about after interviewing Tim and Lisa, his boss, last week. And it's on my website. And everybody has copies of it in front of them.
And that website is mitechnews.com.
Thank you. That'll be a shameless plug, Bill. Yep. Very good. Right. I'll get the $50 later, Matt.
Okay.
So let's talk a little bit about that. Now, one of the themes of this show is just sort of, I don't know how it worked out like this, but AI and machine learning, which you're really big on in this report, talking about how that's going to be a major factor in so many areas. Let's start with that. That's really the real main part of your tech trends, right, and how that's going to impact Michigan in a variety of ways, right?
Indeed. And just a little bit of background, Airfoil Group is a tech-focused PR agency. And so by nature, we're always looking at what's coming next. What are those, to borrow a phrase, I believe it was Wayne Gretzky, but I'm not sure, knowing where the puck is going to be, and trying to stay ahead of the developments that are happening in the technology sector, which are a lot of them. But yeah, as you mentioned, AI and machine learning are affecting, nearly every client that we do business with. You know, every discussion that we have with clients, they come up somehow. And I think in the tech report, what we really focus on is two things around AI. One is the inroads that it's making in the healthcare industry. That's a huge area for investment and growth. It has a number of applications in healthcare. But also the other side of that is AI and machine learning are becoming, as we put it, more democratized, where those used to be things not too long ago, just a few years ago, where companies would have to make these great investments and build up those teams, which was, it's a pretty brand new, at least in the advanced form that it is now, it's a brand new area of expertise. But what's happening now is all these cloud platforms, Google Cloud and Amazon and Microsoft, they're building in AI applications so that businesses can, upload their data to the cloud, a lot of data, and AI and machine learning can sort of parse it and make sense of it and help them drive business decisions.
Well, since we're in Michigan, let's talk a little bit in the beginning here about the change in the vehicle industry and the car business with all this media streaming to vehicles. Let's talk about what you see happening there.
It's in a very exciting phase of evolution right now where I think, the media coverage of it, there might be a misconception there that it's more advanced than it actually is. I mean, there's a lot of ongoing development there, but with, autonomous vehicles, with fully electric vehicles and with fully connected vehicles, that's still a few years down the line. With the automotive sector in general, I think the exciting things that will be happening in the next few years is, you know, A, that transition to maybe, you know, more and more OEMs concentrating on electric vehicles, which is a lot of overhead. It's a lot of processes that need to be changed. But, you know, there are evolutionary steps in between where combustion engines, I think in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, we're going to see some incredible gains in fuel efficiency, incredible gains in, you know, emissions reduction, that kind of thing. So I don't think, you know, I don't think combustion engines are going anywhere in the next few years. And if anything, it's going to be a boom for those cars, which are going to be cheaper, especially on the lower end, than electric vehicles and a lot of the things that are happening in the evolutionary phase of automobiles.
Richard, do you want to go ahead and chime in?
Richard Seenan here. I saw Elon Musk give his autonomy presentation with his top guys, and it was quite compelling. And he was talking about doing a software update to all the current, most of the current generation of vehicles this October, in a flip of a switch, and they'll be autonomous vehicles.
Yeah,
it was pretty cool stuff.
I'm buying that too. Right, pigs are flying outside the building right now as we speak.
When you see the machine learning that they're doing, I always thought that autonomous vehicles would be all these algorithms and software engineers would be making decisions about whether to hit two people or one or how to swerve away when somebody cuts into your lane. And they go, no, they've got data from so many vehicles driving, over a million. They just pull in all this video with all the 6 or 8 sensors that they've got in each vehicle, and they train it real time to deal with cars swerving into your lane, you know, in the – you know, signal on, guy crosses the lane. Right. It's amazing.
I still have that image of that car, that woman that was driving it, that safety driver that ran over and killed that passenger, that person crossing the street. I think of that. And I go, I don't think so. You know, so.
Right.
And it always kind of reminds me of the scene in the Will Smith iRobot movie where the robot decides to save Will Smith and not the little girl. So that's a
good point.
Yeah, hard ethical decisions must be made here.
So
And I think, I mean, what you said, it's true. A lot of these things are in cars now, right? So a lot of advanced driver assist technologies, that's the real world right now. But it's a huge jump to say that, you know, in the next few years, there's just going to be cars without drivers driving around. There are some test scenarios going on, some pilot tests. But for the most part, and I think actually in every aspect of that, they're on predefined routes, right? So it's like point A to point B. It's something that they can calculate ahead of time. It's something that they can, you know, build towards and map out specifically. But yeah, fully autonomous, we're still a few years away, but that doesn't mean it's not exciting. There are a lot of technologies that are, you know, already realized right now where, as you mentioned, there's a greater societal impact that we got to think about, right? You know, those ethical decisions, those, you know, if a car can work autonomously in a suburban area, does that mean it can work in the middle of New York City? Yeah, probably not.
No.
So it's a lot of those things, but it's an evolution. And I think before we get to fully autonomous cars, we're going to have a lot of interesting things happening both on the, you know, electric side and on the combustion engine side as well.
All right, let's talk about healthcare a little bit. How do you see AI transforming healthcare?
That is one of the biggest areas of investment right now for artificial intelligence. According to Accenture, they're projecting that it could be, you know, $150 billion a year saved by AI applications in the healthcare industry. And I think that's because there are so many applications for it, from computer vision, being able to, you know, very quickly and very accurately pinpoint things in medical imaging or radiology, as well as maybe more, you know, bread and butter things like automating documentation and administrative tasks. But there is a ton of investment going on in AI and healthcare. And as that market grows and matures, I think that, you know, it presents an opportunity for marketers, for PR types like myself to, you know, be able to cite real world metrics, not just in saving money, but in how effective these AI solutions are as compared to maybe a human doing the same task.
We've got about 4 minutes left. Let's not forget to get into the industrial Internet of Things, because that's what we do here in this state. And I saw another report that Plex did about a month or so ago, And that's what they do. And even them that specialize in manufacturing, they only had about 30 or 40% of the companies they surveyed that actually were big on IIoT. But I probably should explain what that is. But go ahead. I'll let you do that.
Oh, sure. I mean, at a basic level, it is, you know, building more sensors and more advanced computing capabilities into, you know, traditional machinery. That could be everything from industrial machinery, which is probably, you know, the use case that is talked about the most. But it could be also something like a coffee machine, like an industrial coffee machine, building in sensors and compute capabilities into those things to be able to, you know, the manufacturers of those machines can unlock new revenue streams that way, where they're offering their machines as a service rather than a, you know, you buy it, you maintain it through a third party, that kind of thing.
And if I remember that's one of your clients, one of the airfoil clients, right? That you're describing there.
Yes, they're active in you know, taking IoT technologies, not even on the hardware side, but on the data driving results side. And that's, you know, that's another application of AI that goes hand in hand with IoT, where the IoT has been around for a few years. Sensors are in everything. And what that has done is created just vast amounts of data that pretty much no human being on Earth, except for maybe a few, can parse and make sense of and use that to drive real business decisions, sometimes on the fly, where, you know, machine learning and AI is really designed to do that, to take in all this data, find patterns in it, be it from, you know, business decisions to sales to, you know, just user data, and be able to help companies make decisions out of those vast range of data. I was just saying that the trend that we're seeing is that is presenting itself in some surprising ways. When you think of IoT and data, you think of, you know, a spreadsheet that, you know, that AI is able to parse and say, like, hey, maybe we should invest more here. Oh, maybe this, you know, this area of our business isn't working out so well. But it's doing things like allowing companies that make machines that have this technology built into it to, you know, it's sort of making it the Netflix of industrial environments, where they can rent out a machine, and based on the readings of those machines, they can do stuff like predict failure. They can do stuff like predict, you know, what areas of their business they don't even concentrate on now might have, you know, high paying customers. I think the IoT, the trend that we're seeing is that there's a lot more creative aspects of using all this data. And again, like I said, with AI in the healthcare industry, there's going to be more hard evidence, I think, in the coming years of what IoT can do and the various ways it can work for a company.
All right, Tim, we've got about a minute left. If people want more information about Airfoil or the Tech Trends Report, where should they go online?
It is airfoilgroup.com, accessible from any internet browser with an internet connection. But yes, it's our trends report, and I believe you have it linked on your website as well.
Yes, we do. We have your story. Great. I put it out this morning. You can hit the bell again.
Okay,
if you
like. There we go. Okay. That would be mitechnews.com.
Thank you, Matt. Okay. Yes, I'm up to $100. So
and you got to mention Lawrence Tech a couple of times.
Oh, yes, yes.
Now.
We'll get that in. Well, we're going into the Lawrence Tech commercial next, so we're good. So anyway, Tim Moynihan, thanks for calling in from New York. That string was very tight today, and we could hear you very clear, right? Bad joke.
Yes, thank you. Yes. Thank you very much for having me.
All right, we'll talk to you again soon, Tim. For right now, this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M2 TechCast.
Lawrence Technological University graduates earn a degree and a higher starting salary. In fact, when it comes to earning potential, the Brookings Institution ranks LTU fifth among U.S. colleges and universities. Be enriched. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
As a Lawrence Technological University graduate, you're not only marketable, you're worth more. Yes, more. According to payscale.com, when it comes to graduate salaries, LTU is in America's top 100. Be invaluable. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Hey, it's Matt Roush.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're back with another segment of the M Squared TechCast. We have our regular, I think it's monthly, visit from cybersecurity expert Richard Steenen. And he's here to scare the bejeebers out of us again.
He is, yes. And we have, just sitting across the table here, is Caston Thomas, who's
another guy who's
here to scare
scared.
Us to death. Yeah. And they're going to 1-2 us here in the next two segments. So if they want to play off each other, go for it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So. When I have questions, I call Caston.
That's it, yes.
Okay. Wait a second. I was going to tell you that I'm standing in the shadow of Richard Steenen. It's a mutual admiration society.
Okay, good.
Well, Richard and I go way back to ResNet, which was
94.
Yeah, I thought it was back in the 90s. I couldn't remember. So
long time.
Yeah, where'd the time go, right? Hoo-hoo. Yep. So anyway, what's hot? I mean, you were mentioning Baltimore when I was asking what you want to talk about.
Yeah, so Baltimore is kind of the creating a little furor in the cybersecurity industry because people are arguing about whose fault is it. So Baltimore, the city of Baltimore, succumbed to a ransomware attack, and the attackers asked for an outrageously large ransom to decrypt all their systems.
Mm-hmm. Well, in hindsight, it wasn't that outrageous.
Yeah. Yeah, true. Compared to the actual losses they suffered, they should have just paid it.
What was they asked? You remember?
I forget what they asked was.
$78,000.
Oh, is that it? That's not bad. Insurance company could cover that, right?
I was going to say, you could buy a newspaper reporter for a whole year with that.
Because you mentioned insurance, it came up in a conference I was at in Cincinnati on Thursday, and there's an cyber insurance expert talking. And it was the first time I actually realized that insurance companies pay the cyber ransoms when this happens. And they look at it and they decide that's the best solution.
Sometimes.
Sometimes they do. And they have to make sure that you weren't egregiously at fault yourself. But
didn't do your patches and you got old systems that are really crappy. That's the problem that the cities have is they don't have the money to upgrade.
But they end up having the money to repair, so they should just think ahead. It's always been my contention is they should do some sort of tabletop exercise so they understand what they're faced with and get the funds now to prevent that horrible event happening.
Well, that's the way local government infrastructure is supposed to work in all cases, right? You're supposed to have a sinking fund where you anticipate future
or a rainy day
needs.
Or whatever.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. You should do that for garbage collection and sewers and water retention.
Well, as we can see from our roads, that does not always happen. But
go there. Huh?
Our roads are being treated like Social Security, right? Social Security was supposed to be a slush fund for our retirements, and no, they just spend it when they
however they want to, right? Mm-hmm.
Just like you do with your own budget.
Yeah. Scary.
I can't print money, though. You know, I've tried. They don't like it when you do that.
It's a special paper that hangs you up, so.
Okay.
So it's been a crazy world on the acquisition side of things. So there were three major acquisitions totaling $1.5 billion.
Wow.
Yeah, so money. FireEye bought FireEye is, publicly traded big company, and they bought a company called Verodin that I've been tracking closely, and I worked with them, wrote a white paper, they did a bunch of nice videos of me talking.
Verodin, I'm not familiar with that.
So they do security instrumentation.
Oh.
So they put sensors all over your security devices like your firewalls and IDS and SIM.
Uh-huh.
And then they attack it from the outside with 3,000 different scenarios, and then they measure to see if your security controls are working. Because a lot of times you just say, okay, I'm going to block that kind of attack, but you never go back and test it.
Yeah.
Right? So you don't know if it's actually working.
So Baltimore should have done that then,
Baltimore's got a lot more to do before they get to that because they don't have the security controls in place to test.
There's this thing called baseline that you ought to meet first before you do anything.
Yeah. And it should be set at, whatever you, Mike, are doing for security, they should have been doing for security. So Verodin was one. Another one is in the threat intelligence space, a pretty cool company called Recorded Future. Got acquired for $780 million. So that was a big deal.
Who's the buyer?
It'll come to me in a second.
Bigger than a bread box.
It's all right. That's an interesting name anyway.
Yeah. It's very cool. The other one was Twistlock. That was acquired by Palo Alto Networks.
So what does this mean? The big age of consolidation has started? Or?
No, not consolidation. That never happens in cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. So vendors acquire companies that add the strategic technology that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not consolidation, which would be, you know, Symantec buying McAfee. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen very often. Mm-hmm. Occasionally it does. And there's some roll-up activity in the managed security service provider space where, mm-hmm. you know, three or four will get together and all of a sudden they got 100 people instead of 30 each.
Makes sense.
So it's an indicator that there's a lot of money sloshing around mm-hmm. for these kinds of deals to get done.
Mm-hmm.
It means there's probably – and the valuations are outrageous, 32x backward-looking revenue. So mm-hmm. last 12 months revenue times 32 is the price that these guys are getting.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty phenomenal. If you've got a little security business, now's the time to think about selling.
Wow.
Well, you know, there had been a – downtrend in acquisitions for a long time.
And in valuations, too.
And one of the things that I had pointed out, you know, Cisco and Microsoft had been purchasing, a lot of other companies purchasing security companies before they really were ready to be acquired because it cuts the innovation when the big guys buy them.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see how Recorded Future. They were purchased by Insight Partners, I believe.
Is who yes, yeah, that's a private equity firm, right? And they had been an investor in them before.
Yeah, so, and then seeing what General Matthews is doing, I wish FireEye had used him as their keynote interview rather than the person they invited. But that's a whole different story. But Verodin is doing some amazing things, and I think it's a really intelligent move for FireEye to purchase
them.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a gem. And then, you know, kind of along the same lines, there's the other thing that can happen in the space is really big companies say, hey, we should do a security thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen that really since the RSA conference 2 months ago, where we had Microsoft announce that they got a new SIM product as if there weren't 50 already.
Mm-hmm.
And Google announced a new SIM product as if there weren't 51 already.
Yeah, but it's not ready for market yet.
No. But they've got a lot of data.
That's true.
That's the argument right now. We have more data. I mean, who's got more data, Google or Microsoft? And you could argue Microsoft probably got some pretty critical data in the enterprise. And then finally, Alien Vault acquired by AT&T and formed their new division, AT&T Cybersecurity.
Mm.
And I've got a call scheduled with them next week, but I'm not sure where the managed service that AT&T does is going to fit into all of that.
Okay.
Well, what are the biggest threats you see on the horizon? What's big right now?
Yeah. So, you know, Dan Lorman was asking on LinkedIn, you know, is this the tip of the iceberg? You know, the WannaCry style ransomware that we see out there. And pretty much I agreed with everybody who answered that, yeah, this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Mm.
And that's the trouble. If ransomware attackers are actually getting paid off by insurance companies, they're going to start targeting people who have cyber insurance.
Right.
Just as kidnappers target people who have kidnapping insurance, mm-hmm. right, once they discover that.
Or have money.
Or have money. Or are big.
Yeah.
I guess one of the clauses, if you have kidnapping insurance, is you are not allowed to tell your kidnappers that you have insurance. Because that raises the price.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
Immediately. So it's going to be the same thing with ransomware cyber insurance. So we're going to see, and the cyber insurance guys are figuring all this out, right? But it's mm-hmm. a mature enough industry now. They've got statistical information. So they're getting better at offering products that really do pay out instead of always having an escape clause.
How many companies have cyber insurance? Do you have any idea percentage-wise?
No, I don't. But there are 750 claimed providers of cyber insurance.
No kidding.
But most of them are just reselling. It's closer to 100 or 125, I think.
I wonder if that's something that I remember back when a million years ago when I was a finance writer at Cranes, there was this company here in Detroit called H.W. Kaufman that would mm-hmm. insure bizarre risks, like strange, weird stuff like you never thought of. Like, I remember one of them sticks in my head, rampaging circus elephant insurance. You know,
we all need that for
if
sure.
If you have a wild animal show and the animals go crazy and hurt somebody, then you can buy insurance for that.
I wonder what the deductible is if I don't own an elephant.
Yeah.
Deductible's higher if you have a Tiger, right? Yeah.
Considerably, yes.
Well, there was a bit of a kerfuffle over that, too, because during the WannaCry and NotPetya outbreaks, a lot of companies lost hundreds of millions of dollars. So Maersk and a couple others claimed over $500 million each in losses. They went to make insurance claims. And NotPetya in particular was the result of Russian attacks against Ukraine. So the insurance company says, you might not have missed the fine print that said if it's an act of war, you're not covered. And they claim that it was an act of war.
Oh, yeah. The insurance companies like to take your money. They just don't like to pay you anything.
This is true.
You know? So, yeah. Well, that would be a shocker, huh?
Yep. Well, it is.
Force majeure.
There will be cyber war, as the book title says, right?
I've heard of that, yeah. Who wants that?
Ring the bell.
Ring the bell.
Okay.
Okay.
So... Wow, huh? Where is this coming from? I mean, is everyone thinks it's the Russian and the Chinese or the Eastern Europeans? Is there any way to pinpoint who all these folks are that are doing all these attacks?
So all of the the ones that have nation state motivations to, for instance, take out Ukraine,
right.
That's coming from Russia.
Yeah.
There's pretty good attribution in most of those cases just based on the malware samples and the techniques and processes that they use and the tools that they're deploying. These cyber criminal attacks invariably come from Eastern Europe. If you're in the U.S., if you're in South America, they all come from Brazil because that's where all the good carters and bank Trojan horses come from. China doesn't engage as much in hacking for money, but they certainly engage in hacking for data. So China is credited with the Anthem attack and the Office of Personnel Management attack. And you just imagine they're accumulating a database of all U.S. citizens. From OPM, they got all the security clearance information for everybody who's ever applied for one.
Really?
So then they can put that in their big data machine learning system, and they can start making connections. And they realize, through an insurance company, if they get other financial data, they say, wow, this person here who has a top secret security clearance is having financial troubles and his home was foreclosed on. Maybe we should approach that person and suggest that we could help
those wily Chinese. Huh?
Have a relationship. Yeah. Right. Oh, man. Yeah.
Wily spycraft.
Yes, I like that. Wily Coyote. Remember that? anyway, yeah. So what else is going on out there that we can scare people with?
So I guess the one indicator that the cybersecurity market is growing, on one side of it, it's the attacks we see, which are the drivers for the cybersecurity industry. So as you know, I track the entire industry, and I stepped out of it for 2 years, to take a real job, come back into it.
Didn't work out so good, though, huh?
Yeah, it worked out great, actually.
Got the bills caught up, right?
Yeah, I guess I'm unemployable.
Yeah.
But I came back and I said, okay, let's restart this and let's go back and catalog them all. I've had to get rid of 20% of the companies I used to have, and I've added about 40% new companies just in 2 years.
No kidding.
So even if you're unemployable, you are very consultable.
Yeah, very consultable. Just approach me. I'll share all the information I know at a dollar a minute.
You've got NDAs and you've got
– Richard Steen and Data Dump.
People don't share NDA information with me other than at bars.
Yeah. That's the old reporter trick because I always get my best stuff at a cocktail party.
After a couple of beers.
Because then people are just standing there talking to their friends, spilling their guts, and you just happen to stand by and listen, and then you get all your leads.
Yep.
So we got about a minute and a half left. So and then we'll touch on how people can reach out to you, and then we'll, of course, have you stick around for the next two segments.
And shameless plug,
ring the bell
for my next project called Security Yearbook 2020. So I'm writing an entire history of the IT security industry.
Whoa.
The advice is always write what you know, and I know that better than anything else.
Yeah.
So hey, Richard, sign my yearbook.
Exactly. We're going to put pictures of everybody in this. Yeah,
I like it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be cool.
It'll be fun.
All right. So if folks want to follow you, I know you're all over the place. Why don't you tell them how to do that?
Yeah, just find me on Twitter. I'm at Cyberwar. And then I
– LinkedIn. You used to have your cyber security group, but you sold that or something, didn't you?
Yeah. I'm on you know, it-harvest.com, mm-hmm. security-yearbook.com.
So write for that little New York magazine occasionally, too?
Forbes, yeah. So I write for Forbes.
Uh-huh.
Search for him on Amazon. He's all over the place.
Yeah. He's got his books all over the place.
Got an author's page on Amazon.
His master's thesis is now a book.
Yep.
There will be cyber war. Hit that bell one more time. I'm plucking the heck out of him. Okay. You know, so.
And that's Richard Steenon, Steenon.
Very good. And okay. You owe him $50 now.
No, right. I wouldn't want the people to get the E and the I confused.
Oh, okay.
I before E.
Yeah. Okay. Right. We'll be back with another segment of the M Squared TechCast in just a moment. For right now, this is Matt Rouse.
And Mike Brennan.
And you've been listening to the M Squared TechCast.
What do you get at Lawrence Technological University? Everything. Great labs and studios, supportive professors, plus a full campus life, NAIA athletics, and all the software you need to succeed. Be smart. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Lawrence Technological University is all about opportunities. You learn beyond the campus, doing real-world research for top companies and honing your skills through co-ops and internships. Apply what you learn. Be challenged. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're back again with segment three of today's M Squared TechCast.
It sort of focuses on a theme.
Yes,
AI,
it's very, very much a cybersecurity theme today.
Cybersecurity. Yep. And carrying on with that theme is Kasten Thomas, who's the co-host of the Internet Advisor on WJR, which he lets me appear on for a few minutes every Saturday. But let's talk a little bit about what you want to talk about, which is the Internet of Things, which sort of relates to what we were talking about earlier with AI and machine learning and everything. It all ties in together. And how networks are changing as a result of IoT, the Internet of Things.
Well, before we go there, the thing that's on my mind now is the voice on that break, which was Foster Braun.
Yeah.
God rest his soul.
I think that's the first time I've heard his voice since he died back in January, and my heart's breaking. I mean, what a man.
I miss him.
Well, and we continue to use him as long as I'm not sure how we can carry that over when we do go into the video world. We'll probably have to do new intros, but I don't know. I have to talk to the boss here who's sitting next to me how we're going to work all that out here in the next month or so. But anyway, getting back to your topic, Kasten, tell us all about how you see networks changing as a result of IoT.
Well, there are some what I call mega trends within networks, and you know the big one is that in 1980, I think it was, or 1978, there were 70 nodes on the internet worldwide. You know, and they were these huge computers at universities.
Big research schools. Right?
Yeah. And today there are 25 billion devices on the internet.
And it's only increasing exponentially.
In 5 years, the projections are that it's going to triple again to 75 billion. That may be an underestimate.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be a free-for-all and a smorgasbord for the bad guys, right, unless you're protected.
Well, not necessarily, because the nature of the devices, the nature of networking, and the nature of security with these devices changes. It doesn't mean they're invulnerable, but, you know, you talk to any information security professional, they'll tell you the weakest link is the human beings involved.
Right.
And so since you don't have that loose screw behind the keyboard – on these Internet of Things devices, the way you secure them, the way you monitor them is different. And again, it doesn't mean that they're secure necessarily, but I'm actually quite optimistic about where security's going. And there are things like automating security processes, some great defense-grade technology that's coming out.
Mm.
So I look at, and I know that Richard's dying to jump in here when I make this statement, but when I look at the year-to-year improvement of the metrics, big one is the Verizon annual cybersecurity report.
We keep
seeing that those big scale metrics are improving significantly. Mm. You know, those are the ones like the time that a hacker will dwell before being detected, or the amount of time it takes to resolve the problem once the hacker's detected. We're making continual progress year after year on improving those numbers.
Huh. Richard? Yeah, oh, identify yourself, by the way. New segment. So,
yeah, Richard Steenen. So I write about cybersecurity often, and I'm always an optimist, regardless of, you know, your thinking I come in here just to frighten you and keep you awake at night. It is at least the potential for being secure has increased as dramatically as the threats have. So whenever I see one of these new breach reports, you know, it's always an indication that somebody just wasn't taking advantage of all the technology and processes and disciplines.
So that's generally the problem then, is that there is technology to protect you. Just have to use it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And just phenomenal,
well, that's part of it.
Phenomenal technology out there that, if properly deployed to everything, is will do its job. And now there's an upper limit to how much you can spend, but the whole goal of all of your spending should be to increase the cost for the attacker. So to get them to the point, and this is an old concept, but we have to spend as much on security to force the attacker to physically penetrate our environments.
Richard, you've been reading my LinkedIn feed, because this morning I made a point. And the best way to find me is on LinkedIn. So when we get to that point, it's like, search me on LinkedIn. Yep. But the really important thing about cybersecurity is that old story of the two men who are running away from the tiger. And he says, we have to run away from the tiger. The other guy says, no, I just have to run faster than you.
Yep.
Really, what we're doing is we're making it more costly for hackers to be involved. Because as profitable as it is, if we can reduce the amount of reward there is, then they're going to become less incented to do it, which means they're going to do less activity because they'll go where the other money is.
Right. It's analogous to just making your house hard enough to break into that they will break into the next door neighbors.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
It's not quite as hard to break into.
Yeah. Right. So. But, you know, the whole piece of that is that when we get these cyber reports that Richard's talking about, there's this intersection of us security professionals who tend to be very cynical and very pessimistic. And then you've got the media, not present company, of course, who wants to hype the bad news because bad news sells.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
So we get this thing that you can have this brilliantly optimistic report, but they find the one thing where the world is falling and the sky's going to fall, and that's what gets all the attention. Mm-hmm. So we are making
cyber
great progress.
Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Yep.
Or somebody shutting down the power grid or exactly. Something like that.
So, Matt, yeah. I used to use that metaphor of protecting your home all the time.
Yeah.
And then I went to South Africa. So I used to talk about, hey, if you've got automatic lights that turn on and you've got a guard dog and you got alarms, they're going to break into your neighbor's house, not yours. So then I go to South Africa, and people there live in gated communities, surrounded by 10-foot walls with barbed wire on top.
Mm.
Inside the community, once you get past the guard shack, you drive up to your house, which is also surrounded by a 10-foot fence with barbed wire on top.
Gosh, I want to move there, huh? Yeah.
You get inside your house, you have to install rape gates at the top of your stairs so all the kids in the family can sleep behind a gate. So the guys who do break in steal the TV, but they don't get to your family. That is how far this metaphor goes.
Wow. Yeah. And people want – and they live like that, huh?
I talk to people who've lived there, and I says, how can you live like that? Why? What's the problem?
Well, the alternative is.
Live in Duluth or Mackinac Island.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
Where you don't have to lock your doors. Right.
No, Matt wants to live in Traverse City. Same thing. So, I mean, you know, no one locks their doors in Traverse City.
I think they probably do now.
Think they do.
But we digress. Yes. How did we get to Beaver Island, guys? So, you know, it's not just the number of devices. It's the types of devices that are changing, but it's also the network that's changing.
Mm-hmm.
We're finding new ways of Wi-Fi working. Wi-Fi is doing the same thing that's happening to 3G, to 4G, to 5G, is that the amount of coverage that a single antenna or a single radio will cover is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. But what that does, it allows you more control over the network signal, because as these new 50 billion additional devices come on, the overwhelming majority of them are either going to be Wi-Fi AX, now known as Wi-Fi 6, but 5G as well. And I'm hearing rumblings that 5G and Wi-Fi committees are actually starting to collaborate to converge those two standards so that devices will be able to move seamlessly between Wi-Fi 6 and beyond and 5G and beyond.
One radio?
Don't know that yet. I mean, it's the early stages of collaboration.
Are those on separate – those are separate parts of the electromagnetic spectrum though, but they
– Well, there are separate radio frequencies, absolutely. Yeah. But in 5G, there's going to be a new frequency opening up that's much closer to Wi-Fi. You know, we get into government regulations on how that bandwidth is allocated. If – you have a consistent standard, you don't have to change all of the antennas. You just simply change it so that the radios and the devices are able to communicate on the spectrum that's best for them.
Okay.
Now, the other thing, I've been reading a lot of initial stories about the 5G rollout, and it hasn't exactly been smooth. But what is 5G down the road going to do to the Internet of Things?
Well, it's going to give much, much greater bandwidth. That's the big, big thing. But it's also going to minimize the size of what are called the cells.
Mm-hmm.
And so if people have microcells in their home, you know, AT&T provides those and some other people provide them.
Comcast.
You're actually going to have radios that are on stop signs every 100 feet in a neighborhood.
Mm.
And that's going to serve it rather than these massive towers. And because you're in smaller areas and because the frequencies are different, you're actually going to have lower transmission signal.
Mm-hmm.
So the power's not going to be great. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of concerns about how all the radio frequencies affect our bodies.
Mm-hmm. That too, I've heard about that. Yeah.
Some of that is overhyped. If you just do a search on 5G malicious or 5G bad stuff, you're going to get all of these. Probably the first 20 that I saw when I looked are just, you know, they're these hype over things that aren't scientific at all. They're just there to scare people.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean we shouldn't be concerned
mm-hmm.
because most of the studies that have been done on the harmful effects of these signals have been financed by the carriers.
Mm.
So we need some of the independent studies that are on as large of a scale and as well funded as what the carriers are doing to make sure that everything's going as we move forward and these things start to saturate our brains.
But for a guy like me who's moving rapidly into video in a big way, 5G at some point, maybe a year or so out, is going to be great, right?
Oh, you'll have gigabit to the home through the Wi-Fi, which means now we're not going to have fiber to the home because you'll be able to provide it through the 5G signal.
And so you can carry a camera, like you'll be max headroom.
Yeah, I like that.
Carry a camera around and report.
I like that.
Yeah,
I'll figure that out. I could do that whole thing that he does too. I mean,
So the signals are going to be different, and you're going to find that these are going to be on every light post going down the highway because as automobiles are transmitting data from the car, you know, GM's going to want to know where every pothole is, and they're going to want a photograph of that pothole so that they can steer other cars around it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's coming with the connected car. So we need that kind of bandwidth for the automobiles to be able to transmit that kind of telemetry.
Now, we got a little less than 2 minutes left, so we can't get into a long-winded explanation. But security on cars, if this is kind of scary. I mean, do the OEMs got this figured out?
No.
We're trying. It's a microcosm of the entire security industry. They have to do everything that we've done before for a data center.
Right.
They have to treat the car like a data center and have a complete security stack, encryption, behavior analysis.
Sure.
And there's a company for each one of those capabilities already.
Ah. All right, let's wrap with talk to people about the Internet Advisor since you run outfit. Got about a minute left.
The world's changing and we're changing a bit as well. You know, we've been answering calls about, you know, my PC just blue screened or I can't get my Windows XP to talk to my 2018 printer kind of thing. We're finding ourselves more engaged and people are very interested in the technological change, the benefits and the things that we should watch out for.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes medical. It includes topics like 5G. It includes, you know, our baby monitors getting hacked because, you know, those are on the internet now.
And no security. They just have admin and password is 123456 or something.
Well, there are cases of that, but the white hat hackers, as they're called, are doing a lot of work. And, you know, Best Buy and Amazon aren't going to be selling those devices that don't support that because there's a liability for them as well if they ignore those warnings. So the manufacturers, when it does come to light, are correcting things. And if they don't, then they're finding that they don't have a market.
All right, we got to wrap this segment. We got one more coming, but real quick, people want to find out how they can listen to Internet Advisor. They do what?
They listen on WJR from 6 to 7 on Saturday evenings.
760 a.m.
Yep. We're also available on TuneIn. You can listen on the WJR app anywhere in the world. We release on podcast weekly, and we're also regionally syndicated.
That's right. I forgot that.
Across Michigan, and I actually heard that we're on two or three stations in Ohio or Indiana, but I can't find any more about that.
Okay.
So
okay.
If you are listening to us in Ohio, let me know.
Yeah,
all
great.
All right. Well, we're going to take us out, Matt.
All right, Kasten Thomas, thanks very much for the visit. Come back again soon. We'll be back in just a moment with another segment. For right now, this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M-Squared TechCast.
Lawrence Technological University is more than a school. It's a launchpad for your future, offering industry-leading facilities and 100-plus programs that are ranked among the nation's best. Be unstoppable. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Lawrence Technological University graduates earn a degree and a higher starting salary. In fact, when it comes to earning potential, the Brookings Institution ranks LTU fifth among U.S. colleges and universities. Be enriched. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're back with another segment of the M Squared TechCast. We have with us, I believe, on the line, Patrick Anderson, the well-known East Lansing economist who's also got a data analytics firm going. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Good day to both of you.
So are you driving right now? I hear a little bit of road noise in the background.
My wife is driving right now.
Oh, okay.
Tell her to put the windows up.
Yeah. All right, sounds good.
All right, so Patrick was just in Europe last month. I think, May 25th? You were there to do a briefing with the good folks there on the new regulations that have come out by the Europeans, the general data protection regulations. And the other thing, well, reason that Patrick was there in part because he has his own AI, artificial intelligence company called Supported Intelligence. And so you've got a little expertise in that area. Why don't you tell folks what you told the folks that were attending this conference at Evian Laban in France? I think I got that right.
You did. Congratulations. But let's keep this as the Michigan Tech News. I don't think this is going to quite pass in France for a good French accent. But then my presentation was all in English, too. So we're okay.
Perfect. Okay.
The GDPR was 1 year old, actually 1 year old the day I made this presentation, May 25th. And the presentation I gave there is very relevant to those of us in Michigan and Chicago and Illinois and Ohio and Indiana, other places where Michigan Tech News and the Tech Cast is importantly read, because it applies to customers that are doing business and data that's being collected in Europe and other countries. And I would hazard a guess that a good number of the mid-sized businesses and nearly all the large businesses that operate in the American Midwest are in fact getting data from people in Europe and are using servers and other things that are located in around Europe. So it's very relevant. And the number one thing I'm saying is that businesses and other companies that are capturing customer data, that are actually using that customer data, targeting, classifying, etc., are at risk. The penalties for the misuse of that data. Many of them are unaware of that, and I'm identifying for people in this presentation. Here are some things you as businesses ought to be doing right now.
Okay. And what are those things?
Well, number one, businesses that have customers' data need to know that they have the data and know what data that they have. Part of our experience is a lot of businesses think that data breaches and malware are the only things they need to worry about, and they ask somebody, are we protecting our data, customer data? Oh, yeah, we got passwords and stuff like that. In fact, you have a lot of businesses that have a significant amount of customer data, often that they have collected or that their vendors have collected. For example, in their advertising arrangements, anybody that's using Facebook advertising, anybody that's getting data from Google, anybody that's doing targeted ads or classification is probably already in a situation where they make substantial use of customer data and need to be much more aware of what that data are and how they're using it. So number one is, first, if you're managing a business and you have customer targeting activities going on, you need to be checking right now to see, what data do I have and how am I using it?
Okay. Patrick, this is Richard Steenan joining. So I've looked a lot at GDPR, and I even wrote about the unintended consequences. But what if I don't have any business in Europe? I happen to collect a lot of data from European people, but I don't actually have any business there. Am I still liable?
You are, in fact, liable if you're collecting data from Europe or using servers that go through Europe and services through Europe. And the penalties for improperly classifying customer data, things like that, can range to 1% up to 4% of the company's worldwide turnover or revenue. They use the word turnover in Europe. And before you get to potential penalties, first, what about just here in the United States? You see these headlines about Facebook released this data and Google was allowing companies to troll through people's emails and pick out words people were using in their private communications. Hmm. Those are bad, but you have companies right there, including people who are listening right now, who have buried away in their marketing department or buried away in their underwriting department, are using machine learning algorithms on data. In many cases, they have no idea what's being done. And so the first lesson from this presentation is, if you're a manager, don't wait for your IT department to come and tell you. You should be asking right now, how are my customers being targeted? How are my customers being underwritten, classified? What vendors am I using that are giving me this information? I would be suggesting get ahead of the curve, because the scrutiny is coming.
Okay. And use independent auditors is one of the points you were making,
yeah,
too.
Yeah,
right?
You talked about AI audits in the presentation. Let's hear about that a little bit.
This is a new concept. In fact, in the presentation, I point out that there's no real framework yet for this. The presentation that I made is one of the few where people have written down, here's what you should be doing. The idea is something that other people have pointed out. In fact, the GDPR, which is now law in Europe, says that companies ought to, and organizations and countries ought to, establish a facility for independent people to go in and look at how data is being collected and how the algorithms are being used to classify that data. We really don't have a protocol for doing that. So part of the presentation was, here's three or four steps that someone could be doing. I actually suggest, here's what I think should be done. And there's not a profession or a classification or a standard for this yet, but as a starting point, we identify that companies should retain companies that are consultants that are independent of their existing marketing department or underwriting department, so that their compensation isn't depending on you continuing to use the same software. And go in and simply try to identify the data that's being used. Look at the algorithms, see if you can replicate them, and then see if there's a management process by which you can say, I, as a manager in a company, actually do know what's happening with my customers' data, and I'm comfortable with that. Or if all of a sudden you did know, you can at least take action before you get fined.
Huh. Hang on, we got a plane going over here.
Right. You say... Also in your release here, you said that data breaches and malware are only two of five categories of damages that can emerge from misuse of applications? What are the other three?
So, the good point, most people know about malware. They know you can have ransomware. They know you can have viruses. Most people know about data breaches. I mean, they know, they've read about Facebook. They've read about Cambridge Analytica. They may be aware that Google for many years was allowing people to troll through private emails and figure out what words people were using. Those are two things that people know about. What they may not know about are things like management negligence. And that's part of the call I'm giving is managers, you should be asking the tough questions now. You should be asking, what data do we have and what are we using it for? Including asking vendors. That's a category. And then another category is product efficiency, because one of the things we discovered in our work at Anderson Economic Group is that sometimes these machine learning algorithms, they just don't work very well. In fact, we have one demonstration that's in a published article now that shows that many machine learning algorithms can be worse than a coin flip. I mean, it's just a waste of time and money. And before anybody finds you, wouldn't you like to know whether that expensive customer targeting method that you're using that somebody told you was big data and high tech and cloud ready and everything, maybe it doesn't even work. And that's one of the things that we think independent AI auditors or people that can replicate that can tell you. So those are four categories that you see in the private sector. And then number five, which has occurred in the United States, but is nowhere near what the scale it is in countries like China, is abuse by governments. And that's a real, real danger. I mean, if you're a member of a minority population in China, if you're a political dissident, you're already being subjected to the surveillance state, and facial recognition software tracking, et cetera, is already occurring. And it's very dangerous. We're in the United States. I'm not saying that's happened here yet with the
unless you go to the airport or some government. Public place like or New York, where geez, everything's surveyed there. You know.
Well, when I got on the plane to go to Europe, there I was in the Detroit airport. There was facial recognition software right at the gate.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like it. I don't remember consenting to it, but it was hard to get around it.
Yeah.
You can opt out of it if you like to stand aside while everybody else gets on.
Yeah, I could have opted out and then shouted really loud across the Atlantic,
yep.
I suppose.
Yeah, hard to take a train over there, you know.
We don't have a channel yet, but we should have that, right?
Yeah.
All right, so Richard, did you...
that I think people should be aware of, and again, we're telling people now, when I say people, managers of businesses, managers of nonprofits, universities, schools, if you have these data and you have these fancy customer targeting algorithms, or you have some classification or underwriting, you should be asking these questions now before you get a lawsuit, before you get fined, before you get a big bunch of customer pressure, and before you get a bad headline, and make sure you know what's going on. And if you're not comfortable asking your own folks, or you're not comfortable asking your software vendor, you ought to be able to hire somebody. And this is a service that, you know, we're developing at Anderson Economic Group, an ability to go in and actually audit these algorithms using the same techniques that the people who designed them initially should have been using. See if they work. See if they're doing what you expected, and make sure that the management knows what's happening.
Well, you're going to have a lot of work ahead of you, especially as California's privacy law goes into effect January 1st, and Washington State is getting ready to vote on theirs.
Oh, I didn't know Washington State was. Are they going to join California?
Yeah, it's going to be a little more stringent than California's.
Really?
Yeah. Luckily, the penalties for California are, you know, $100 per record or instance.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
A lot less than 20 million euros.
There's a large e-commerce company based up there in Seattle. It'll be interesting to see how they react to that, right?
Just a little one.
Yeah. Taking over the world. Okay. Talk a little bit about Supported Intelligence, Anderson Economic Group. We got a little over 2 minutes or so left.
Well, Anderson Economic Group continues to be one of the firms that developed some of the techniques that are used ethically a lot of the data we use are data that other people can get, but it doesn't involve customers. And you can do a lot of analysis, some of which is published on our website, some of which we do for our clients, looking at information from the census, looking at for information we get from private sources or that we estimate ourselves. When you mix it with customer data, now is when it gets really dangerous and you need to be careful about it. And so we have people that have the very high skills in computer technology and in statistics and econometrics to do this kind of work. So I agree there's going to be a lot of this kind of work in the future. And I think I'm hopeful that we'll get some people who are professionals and knowledgeable right here in the American Midwest to do it. There's no reason to wait for people in California to invent this. We should be leaders right here in Michigan.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Patrick Anderson from Anderson Economic Group and Supported Intelligence. I want to thank Patrick for appearing on the show today, along with all our guests, and some of them were gifts.
Oh, that's all, folks.
Some of them were gifts. Yes, right. Kasten Thomas, yeah. Richard Steenan, cybersecurity expert, and we kicked off the show with Tim Moynihan from Airfoil Group on Airfoil's annual tech report. Yep. So a security-heavy show today, Mike.
Yep, that's what we do here, right?
That's important stuff. Okay. Well, we'll be back again next Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time here live at PodcastDetroit.com, or you can listen anytime you like wherever fine podcasts are distributed. That includes MITechNews.com, SoundCloud, iTunes, and probably a few other places I've never heard of. Next week, we'll be back with another edition of the M-Squared TechCast. Right now, this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you've been listening to the M-Squared TechCast.
Thanks for listening to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Join your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan, next Monday at 3 p.m. If you can't listen live, audio podcasts of the show can be found at PodcastDetroit.com.